You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Hello, welcome. I see a lot of familiar faces. Good to see you all. Welcome to the Hutchins Center conference on what happened in the repo market, why, and should something be done about it. I'm going to start us off today, and then there will be a number of expert panelists to discuss these specific questions. The rising volatility in the market for short-term collateralized borrowing, known as the repo market, punctuated with a rate spike in September, has drawn public attention to a market usually of concern only to money market participants. The volatility reflects the confluence of significant changes in the financial system since the financial crisis. It reflects changes in the Federal Reserve's monetary operating framework and in bank regulation and supervision. It also may reflect changes in attitudes towards daylight overdrafts and discount window borrowing and changes in the market structure of the financial system. The September episode catalyzed interest in looking at the interactions of these different policies and assessing what is working well and what isn't. Before we rush to changes, however, we need to better understand what happened and why, and that's the goal of this event today. So why do we care about what happened in the repo market? Repo, as you know, is a critical element of the plumbing of the financial system. It is used, for example, by dealers to finance U.S. Treasury securities and by money market funds to invest cash with safe collateral. It supports the primary securities markets and secondary market liquidity. What happens in the repo market can influence other money market rates, including the federal funds rate, which is the target rate for monetary policy. But periodic episodes of volatility in the repo market do not necessarily indicate significant problems in the financial system, though they are definitely worth studying given the important role of repo in the financial system. In the past couple of years, increases in repo rates at month end and quarter ends have become more pronounced as the Fed began to shrink its balance sheet and reserves continued to fall. These increases are reminiscent of the money markets before the crisis, when the Fed operated in a scarce reserves framework, but which basically disappeared with the Fed's new ample reserves approach. But on September 17th, although cash scarcity was predictable, given scheduled corporate tax payments and Treasury settlements, the spike in repo rates was big and took many by surprise. The Fed funds rate moved above its target range. The Fed responded by adding reserves, and money market rates stabilized quickly in the following days. Still, the event raised questions about the ability of the Fed to control the policy rate in an abundant reserves framework. It also led to questions about the demand for reserves and the willingness of banks and dealers to arbitrage in the money markets, which reduces rate volatility. We plan to discuss today what happened, the key policy objectives to keep in mind when considering any changes, and the pros and cons of some possible changes. In particular, given the revealed preference for reserves and what appears to be a steep slope for the demand curve, our two broad and interrelated questions are, would a larger Fed balance sheet with more reserves in the banking system solve the problem without creating others? And should the Fed create a standing repo facility to supply cash when others won't? And second, are there regulations and supervisory practices that are reducing the incentives or the ability of players to lend cash when interest rates spike? And are there changes to regulations and practices that could reduce unwelcome market volatility without risking safety and soundness and overall financial stability? So we'll begin today with two presentations on what happened. First, Trish Mosser, now at Columbia University, formerly deputy manager at the desk at the New York Fed, and then Jerome Schneider, head of short-term portfolio management at PIMCO. They will be followed by former Fed Governor Dan Turullo on policymaker objectives. Then my colleague David Wessel will join the three of them on stage, and we'll turn to further discussion and field your questions. After a short break, we'll come back. We'll turn to a closer examination of the Fed's operating framework and the role of financial regulations. For those of you who are watching online, you can submit questions, and you can submit them by email to HutchinsCenter, one word, at brookings.edu, or at Twitter at hashtag RepoMarker. So with that, I'm going to turn this to Trish Musser, and thank you all for coming.
Thank you very much, Nellie. Good afternoon, everybody. Before leaping into what happened in money markets in mid-September, let me start with a couple of points of background for everybody here and online. And I know many people in this room already know this, so I hope you'll just bear with me for a couple of minutes. First background piece, a few words about U.S. money markets. They are short-term lending, if you like short-term debt markets, used by a wide array of financial institutions and investors and large non-financial companies as well as by the U.S. government and agencies. In maturity, they range from overnight to up to a year, although predominantly they tend to be less than 6 months in maturity. They come in lots of types, commercial paper, tradable bank deposits, treasury bills, I could go on. But for the purposes of today's discussion, we're going to focus largely on the federal funds market and the repo market. The Fed funds market is a short-term lending and borrowing, if you like, between banks and the GSEs. We're going to focus mainly on banks, but the GSEs are also part of the market. Like many other money markets, Fed funds are unsecured, meaning they're promissory notes, effectively. And, of course, the Fed funds market also matters because it is, as Nellie pointed out, the market whose interest rate the Fed targets for monetary policy. In contrast, the repo market is used by many, many different types of firms, and it is much, literally an order of magnitude larger. In addition, it is collateralized, meaning that a lender only provides a short-term loan if a borrower provides collateral, some sort of a long-term security, most commonly U.S. Treasuries and U.S. mortgage-backed securities, agency mortgage-backed securities. Interest rates in money markets do tend to move together. They don't track each other exactly, but they do, for many, many decades, tend to move together over time. In part because it's been relatively easy, at least historically, for participants to move back and forth, lending and borrowing, and even to arbitrage in the market. Of course, another important historical link between the two markets is that the Fed, like many central banks, while it seeks to influence the federal funds rate, actually conducts its borrowing and lending operations in repo markets. That's actually fairly common. So, second background point. One of the consequences of the Fed's very large asset purchase programs, or QE as we all call it, was an equally vast increase in the supply of reserves in total that the banking system had to hold. Here's a picture of the Fed's balance sheet. The assets are on top in blue. The liabilities are on the bottom in orange. And you can see both the size of the QE as well as the equal growth in liabilities on the bottom. The orange section is reserves. Because the supply of reserves was so vast, it was for many years substantially larger than the demand for reserves, even when market interest rates were very close to zero. So supply is systematically above demand. And by the way, that means that the actual trading in the federal funds market has been a shadow of its former self. There's just still trading, but much, much less than it was in previous years. Obviously, when the Fed finished QE and was determining whether to shrink its balance sheet, they viewed that as a long-term process, and so they decided to run monetary policy with this strange supply-demand imbalance in the reserves market. So supply, in fact, they designed their regime around that. I think Bill English is going to say a few words about that later on. So with supply sort of permanently above demand at the current market rate. And given that they were going to run monetary policy with a very large balance sheet for the foreseeable future. So they wanted demand bigger than supply within the operating framework. But here's the quandary. The Fed did shrink its balance sheet. Reserves were shrinking for other reasons as well. So at some point, demand was going to get close to supply, and close to the point where reserves would all of a sudden become interest sensitive again. At what level of reserves was that? To the Fed's credit, they were very clear that they didn't know where that level was, but they were going to try to stay away from it if possible. And in fact, there were a number of surveys or estimates, and then the numbers ranged from $1 trillion to a bit more than that as time went on. So what happened in September? Well, everybody found the downward sloping part of the demand curve for reserves is the short answer. And it was at a substantially higher level of reserves than many had expected. And the immediate impact of that, of course, was that interest rates became immediately sensitive to Fed funds rate. This is a picture of the repo rate in red, the actual federal funds rate in green, and the target range for the federal fund rate are the yellow boxes up there, going back several years. And you can obviously see what happened in mid-September. Now, the proximate cause of, or maybe a better way to put it would be to say the trigger of the events in September and the hiccup, if you like, were very large shifts in a kind of obscure part of the Fed's balance sheet that caused a sudden very large drop in the supply of reserves and probably also increased the demand for reserves at the same time. First, on September 16th, U.S. Treasury had some very big corporate tax receipts plus settlement of a relatively large Treasury auction. And when the private sector decided to pay their tax bills and for their Treasury investments, banks effectively shifted reserves out of their accounts and into the U.S. Treasury account at the Fed. This is a kind of complicated table, but I want you to focus on the two columns that are labeled September 11th and September 18th. The Fed does not publish its balance sheet every day. They only do it weekly. There's a little history on the left if you're interested, but I want to focus on the two columns in the middle, the third and the fourth. You can see what happened in the U.S. Treasury account. Basically, within a day, $150 billion shifted out of reserves and into the U.S. Treasury account because of those events I just talked about. Now, this is weekly data, so the number is only $120 billion because there were some offsets in the intervening days. But you get the idea that it was a very large number, even for a central bank with a big balance sheet. In addition, the other line down here in the obscure part of the Fed's liabilities is the reverse RP pool, which is largely, by the way, reverse repurchase agreements or the Fed lending, but mostly from foreign official institutions, meaning other central banks and so forth, and doing repo with them. That went up during the same week by $40 billion. So the combination of those both directly reduced reserves and created the drop in the supply of reserves. Now, in response to the market kerfluffle, as someone said earlier today, the Fed, as Nellie noted, immediately added reserves the next day. They increased the supply of reserves, not by buying assets, but by actually engaging in repo operations, meaning lending effectively to the core financial intermediaries. In fact, they did that to the tune within a couple of days of $75 billion, which is the circled white part up here. So repos, which had been absolutely zero, obviously all the time that QE was in place, all of a sudden became significant almost right away. In subsequent weeks, the Fed continued to lend out more repo, some of it at longer term, and they also started buying assets, specifically, but not long-term assets that they had during QE, but short-term Treasury bill assets, specifically to raise the supply of reserves. The last column here is the current balance sheet, as of last week, I should say. You can see that the repo pool is now nearly $200 billion. In lending they're doing, and on top of it, they have increased short-term treasuries by $140 billion. So the Fed's overall balance sheet, looking at the assets on the top line, has gone back over $4 trillion. And the amount of reserves in the system, reserves are down here, are back up over $1.5 trillion, almost $1.6 trillion in point of fact. So that's what happened. Kind of technical. That's a technical story. But the underlying drivers of what happened are much, much more complicated, and that's what the rest of today is about. I'm going to give you my little short list of contributing factors. Other speakers are going to expand on that, I know. First of all, the post-crisis regulatory regime clearly has a role to play here. One reason that nobody knew where the demand curve for reserves was, in addition to the fact they hadn't seen it in 10 years, is because during the time of QE and the huge balance sheets, the entire global financial framework around liquidity, counterparty risk, and capital had been completely redone, and for very good reasons. And I want to be very clear here, this is not just about bank regulations and things like the LCR and leverage ratios and liquidity planning for resolution. The structural and regulatory changes for money market funds, in repo markets, in derivatives, even in securitizations, which impacted other money markets, they have all had an impact in the way U.S. money markets function. So this is not a simple thing. It's all about the banks. A second reason, inexperience in money markets that actually function normally, meaning with a little volatility. Back in the day, as they say, meaning for many years before the financial crisis, money market interest rates broadly moved together, not in unison, but together. There was volatility, and sometimes there were even spikes in rates. And those were the days where, A, the Fed was working every day. They did repo operations every day to try to keep the Fed funds rate stable. And not only that, there was active arbitrage on the part of the private sector across different types of money markets. The Fed did not smooth out everything in those days. And they were not expected to smooth out everything in those days. Let me give you an example. The top is repo, Fed funds, and the target ranges again, but this is just for 2019, so it's just for this year. On the bottom, I have exactly the same interest money market rates and the target rate and the same colors, but the year is 2005, so 2 years before the financial crisis. The first thing I want to point out to you is how much all these money market rates bounce around. And not only that, they spike sometimes. I have a few vivid memories of the federal funds rate closing at 11 and 12% at 5% at 5 o'clock on a few days. So volatility, periodic volatility that no one could quite manage is common in money markets and completely, completely normal. A corollary to that, of course, is that there hasn't been actually very active arbitrage in money markets for 12 years. Nobody knows how to do it. The rules of the game have all changed, particularly the regulatory rules. And let me be clear here, I'm not talking again just about the biggest banks, but the entire set of companies who actually function and who actually use these markets. A final complicating factor I want to point out, too, and this has to do strictly with the repo market. Repo is collateralized. If there are very large changes in the quantity of collateral, and here I'm thinking U.S. Treasuries, that can actually impact repo rates. And in point of fact, ever since the U.S. deficits got big, starting in 2018, repo rates, you'll notice in the top chart up here, have actually popped up more than they did back in history before. Sorry. Let me go back to this one. That's not an accident. Lots of extra supply of collateral means lots of people would really like to borrow against it, but there's an excess demand for borrowing, so rates go up. We're going to have big deficits and continued very high treasury supply for the foreseeable future, as far as I can determine. So I wouldn't expect that this is going to be something that goes away. In short, this fall, the financial system has been relearning how to function in what I'll put in quotes as normal money markets, meaning volatility that the central bank doesn't completely preempt and offset, but with a really, really different regulatory regime. This is actually an opportunity to do some learning and to learn about what it is that is making money markets volatile in different ways. And I think a certain amount of learning by everybody might not hurt so much, and it might cause a it might, a nice side effect of that might be just a little less hysteria too. So thank you all.
Thank you and good afternoon. Thank you to the Hutchins Center and Brookings to hold this and to bring some light to a part of the market that only seems to be thought about during times of stress or crisis. And quite honestly, as a practitioner and manager of capital on behalf of clients, this market is of concern. It has raised a lot of awareness and issues, and probably for the first time since the financial crisis, is back at the forefront of a lot of discussion. So it's poignant that we're sitting here today discussing this and really bringing light to the fact that the repo markets are an effective way to, number one, obviously, to transact and conduct monetary policy, but more importantly, it's a rational indicator of what the cost of capital is. And one of the things that you have to think about as a practitioner of capital is how that gets transmitted through the monetary system in a variety of ways. So for us, looking at the repo markets is not only a great barometer of the overall health of the market, as you see it transform from balance sheets of money center banks to the private sector and beyond, but really to thinking about how leverage and cost of capital is really managed. To that end, it's important to highlight what happened, obviously, back in September, but also highlight how the repo markets function and ultimately where we should be thinking about this in the construction of an evolving system of monetary policy. Number one, just to highlight, as Trish mentioned, there's three things, that basically a trifecta of circumstances that happened back in September. The corporate tax day reduced a lot of excess liquidity within the system. That's one clear cause. Number two, an increased amount of collateral which needed to be financed. And as we've also highlighted here, that's going to be a continuing need. So as deficits increase, the continuing demands on financing collateral through primary dealers on those settlement dates is going to be a known at that point in time, but something that's going to have to be dealt with at that point in time. And then the third one is clearly the rebuilding of the cash position at the Treasury, which all led to a consequential deficit in excess reserves in the system that day, or at least perceived that day. Let's put it in context, though. We have had eight times over the course of 2018 and 19 where we've actually had reserve changes of greater amounts than what we had in September, in that mid-September date, meaning that the demand decline in reserves was actually greater than what we witnessed. So why did it happen that date? What happened? Well, obviously, the elasticity or inelasticity of moving the reserves in the system has changed. And that's really what we need to be focused on, is how the transmission mechanism gets permeated through the system at that point in time. So it wasn't anything extraordinary. And more importantly, Treasury settlements happen all the time, and demands of financing happen on a regularly scheduled basis. They're known. That's a fact of the market. And actually, we see spikes in repo rates happen on a frequent basis. When I see spikes, 5 to 10 basis points for a few billion dollars is something that is consequential as a practitioner in the marketplace, but not necessarily of concern. When we think about this, what's clearly happened is that there's become dealer balance sheet inelasticity. And when you combine that with the general opacity within the financial community and really the primary dealer community about how much balance sheet is being allocated to repo, it creates a bit of an illogical discussion of what is the proper rate where repo rate should trade. It's been that way not just for the past 3 months, but really the past 25 years, that there is an equation which dealers may or may not participate in providing the incremental dollar of funding. And I think what we're finding now is that when you combine that with monetary policy and a reduced state of excess reserves or a declining state of excess reserves, it actually creates a little bit more volatility in the market. The question is that volatility bad? And more importantly, is it abnormal? Probably not. And I think that one of the cases that we have to consider today is the fact that we've been relatively subdued in the volatility in the money markets, and we've become accustomed to the fact that there has been basically no volatility in money market rates, including repo rates, for quite some time. But that's not necessarily normal. So adjusting our expectations and adjusting policies to accommodate that rationality is something that we have to do as investors and practitioners within the market, combined with policy and regulatory frameworks. So to even money market participants like myself, some of these situations that were occurring in September were a little bit more opaque in terms of how we approached it. Similar situations don't necessarily lead to the same outcomes over that period of time. All we see is that where those markets price in real time and try to react accordingly. So at PIMCO, we clearly are thinking about this on a proactive basis, being defensive in terms of managing liquidity, having frameworks which help to gauge and sort of be proactive about how to manage liquidity within changing rates and rate conditions. But not everybody has that capability. And what we saw back in September was that that incremental buyer or that incremental borrower of liquidity simply didn't have that degree of freedom that other institutional investors or even retail investors might have at that point in time to take advantage of it. So fundamentally, what we have to do is overcome that inelasticity that I referred to a moment ago and think about how dealer balance sheets can become resilient and more importantly, try to quantify better how balance sheets from those banks, et cetera, are utilized to fund the repo market, especially given higher collateral management and higher collateral needs. So this leaves us where we basically are today. Post-crisis regulation has been impacting the money markets. We've seen it through money market reform. We've seen it through more technical markets like cross-currency basis, where we've seen stresses from time to time. And it can happen for a variety of reasons, and it can be permeating different segments of the market, but it may not. And what we saw in September was clearly it was a pretty defined impact to just the repo markets at that point in time, which actually should be alleviating a lot of broader market concerns. Fundamentally, this isn't a 2008, and that's the number one question we have been talking with clients about. It's not a structural breakage. It's not a counterparty credit risk, so it's fundamentally different in that regard. But what it is a recognition that the cost of funding, the cost of liquidity, is a dynamic, and more importantly, can rapidly change given certain circumstances in time. So what is the role of the Fed? Ultimately, the role of the Fed needs to be thinking about how it can be the lender of last resort at that point in time. Perhaps it's a standing repo facility. Perhaps it's some regulatory relief in the future, how to manage CLAR. But we need to be thinking about how ultimately the banks should be reacting to this and how they could be potentially a beneficiary to the broader marketplace. Context is important. So while 7% or 10% repo rates aren't necessarily ideal, it wasn't destructive to the market long term. The Fed obviously responded to that. But what we are seeing is that banks are being regulated into an unstable equilibrium, meaning oftentimes their degrees of freedom are being curtailed in a lot of ways, which don't necessarily mean for a smooth pricing of overnight repo and zero volatility in the marketplace. Again, something that we should be growing increasingly comfortable with is some modest volatility within the marketplace. Pro-cyclicality in the post-banking crisis has led to some of this, but what we really need to be thinking about is not the primary order impacts of what's going on in the marketplace, but the second order impacts of what regards to regulations, of how those regulations are having on non-bank participants in the market. So the primary dealers have their equation, but it's the secondary participants who may or may not be impacted by those higher rates to come. So in short, what we saw back in September was not a shortage of cash or primary liquidity, but it was a shortage of cash to their internal liquidity buffers of those primary dealers, of those G-SIBs, above their CLAR requirements. So the buffers on buffers are what actually matter at that point in time. The other aspect to think about is simply a little bit of complacency. At PIMCO, we've been tracking the decline of excess reserves as much as anybody has, and yet we still didn't expect the impact on the September hike, or the September settlement date. But what we do see and we have been thinking about is how to be more dynamic in terms of approaching liquidity management. So given the current market environment, it is an ideal time to reflect, as we are here today, to the overall environment and, more importantly, think about ways to actively manage liquidity in the context of a slightly more volatile liquidity and funding cost environment for repo at that point in time. So the consequence is that a large portion of the market simply doesn't understand how their primary funding counterparties and primary funding partners operate. It's going to simply mean that they're going to be carrying a certain amount of higher prudential risk than throughout the cycle of the economic cycle than might be prudent and should cause a bit of hesitation and at least reflection about how to more dynamically approach liquidity management and, frankly, higher cost of capital or changing cost of capital as transmitted through the repo markets. So investors should look to be cognizant of those leverage points. They should be thinking about repo as an indicator of the ultimate cost of capital, and more importantly, secure term funding and ways to mitigate funding risks so they aren't caught offsides of those points in time. And ultimately, that will lead us to take what's happened in September and make it more of a lesson-oriented experience at that point in time. Thank you very much.
So my assignment is to introduce the questions that we might be asking in light of the September repo market disruption that Trish and Jerome have just discussed. In the prepared remarks, I try to level set a bit by identifying three sets of potentially relevant changes that should inform the discussion of those issues. Trish already gave a terrific little précis of the first, which is the change in Fed monetary policy mechanisms and the fact that the Fed has now found out a little bit more about where the kink in the demand curve is, and that played an important role in the September disruption. The second change is, again, Trish alluded to it, the changes in the last couple of years in the Treasury market. With the budget deficit having increased by about 50% in the last 2 years, the supply of new Treasuries that need to be absorbed by debt markets has grown enormously. Another thing that's happened, and Jerome was alluding to this just a moment ago, is that the marginal purchaser of the increased supply of Treasuries has changed. Until the last couple of years, the Fed was the marginal purchaser of Treasuries, right? The bonds under QE. And prior to the 2017 tax changes, U.S. multinationals with large offshore cash holdings were also significant purchasers of Treasuries. Today, though, the marginal purchaser, at least, is probably a primary dealer and not maybe one of the biggest primary dealers. And this shift means that those purchases are going to need to be financed, at least until end investors acquire the Treasuries, and maybe longer. So it's not surprising that the volume of Treasury-backed repo transactions has increased substantially in the last year and a half. You put all of this together, and it seems reasonably clear that digesting the increased supply of Treasuries is going to be a continuing challenge with potential ramifications both for the Fed balance sheet and for regulatory policies. So the third area where the existence or non-existence of change is obviously relevant is in prudential regulation. It's not clear how much of high significance for repo has changed in the last couple of years. But as I think everybody in this room knows, to the degree there have been changes in regulation over the last couple of years, it's been deregulation. Now, whether existing regulations work differently because of the first two set of changes is probably one of the things that people want to take into account. So now turning to my actual assignment, what are the issues raised? I'm going to start with the Fed balance sheet policies, which obviously do relate to monetary policy. Most immediately, will there be another reserve shortage and price spike at the end of the year? The Fed will be only partway through its renewed purchase program, and end-of-year balance sheet window dressing by some banks may further constrict their capacity or willingness to increase their repo market activity. So are the ingredients there for a problem? Yes, it appears as though they may be. Now, I presume that the Fed is just as focused on this possibility as markets are, and that it's going to be prepared to augment reserves as needed toward the end of this month, but we'll see. The more interesting issue is what recent experience implies for balance sheet policies over the longer term. And addressing that issue, I think at least, involves answering two related questions. The first is what is or should be the Fed's tolerance for volatility in Treasury-backed repo markets? You heard both Trish and Jerome refer to the fact that if we haven't been quite vol-free over the last 8 or 9 years, we've been very much vol-suppressed, not just in the repo market, but in a lot of other markets as well. The second question is, given whatever risk tolerance volatility tolerance the Fed does have, what specific balance sheet policies should it adopt? So first, in the October 11th statement regarding monetary policy implementation, the Fed reaffirmed its commitment to an ample reserve monetary policy regime that operates primarily through setting administered interest on excess reserve and reverse repo rates. and does not require the active management of the supply of reserves. The Fed identified the risk it's concerned with as avoiding money market pressures that could adversely affect policy implementation. This is intuitive, right? This is what the guys in monetary affairs are going to worry. Anything that's happening that makes it harder to transmit the FOMC decisions every 6 or 7 weeks. The question I have, though, and the question I think is worth discussing, is whether the Fed understands adverse effects on policy implementation to be more or less synonymous with any spike in repo prices. As Trish said, the pre-crisis scarce reserve monetary policy regime predictably experienced transitory spikes. Is there something about the current policy regime that would make similar spikes more of a risk to effective monetary policy implementation? Relatedly, is there reason to believe that it will be more difficult to distinguish transitory from persistent reserve shortages? And thus, is it desirable for reserve levels to be large enough that they stay comfortably on the flat part of that demand curve? On the other side, though, are there advantages to tolerating some measure of volatility in this market and indeed in other financial markets? Such tolerance would obviously permit a somewhat smaller Fed balance sheet, which the Fed might favor for a variety of reasons. But there's also that broader issue of whether policies that largely suppress volatility in normal times may yield more intense volatility when a significant shock occurs. So that's the first question. What should the volatility appetite be? The second question is, given that, what the balance sheet policies that the Fed should adopt? In the October statement, the Fed noted its intention to continue balance sheet growth as non-reserve liabilities grow. So that's currency, for example. That means that you maintain the reserves at about the level that prevailed in the early part of September. The question to ask is this intended size for a buffer adequate? And the answer to that must in part depend on whether the Fed is now reasonably confident in predicting the effective capacity of banks to respond to spikes in demand for repo. It's pretty clear that pre-September assumptions were not wholly accurate, and there's a variety of factors that may have been at work here. Many have identified regulatory constraints as the culprit, and I'll say more on that in a moment. Others have suggested that the apparent additional reserves of banks may not translate into actual additional repo activity during spikes. Banks have different strategies for holding reserves versus treasuries, some which are at least indirectly driven by regulations, some which are just internally developed. It may also be the case that the internal risk and other limits established by some banks for their treasuries function have not been designed to take advantage of short-term price spikes. There wasn't the incentive to put in place a mechanism for having an exception to your normal limit. A key decision for the Fed will be the means by which it makes additional reserves available given its volatility tolerance and its assumptions about effective bank capacity. I think the most risk-averse approach would probably be to grow the permanent balance sheet enough to maintain a truly sizable buffer of reserves beyond what will probably be a shifting and somewhat uncertain point at which the slope of the demand curve steepens. This, though, would be closer to an abundant or really abundant reserve policy than an ample one. And, of course, all the considerations that have been discussed for years in debates on the right size of the balance sheet will be relevant here. If there's discomfort with the prospect of a larger and possibly quickly growing balance sheet, the Fed might opt for some kind of backup mechanism to deal with surges in repo demand. One possibility is obviously the much-discussed standing repo facility. In his last press conference, Chair Powell hinted that there might be some way to facilitate bank use of intraday overdrafts in their Fed account. Now, either of these or a different kind of facility could presumably be priced to respond to anything more than a hiccup in demand for reserves, if that's what the Fed wanted to do, or not to click in until there was some moderate amount of volatility, and thus not allow some volatility before you start to pump in the liquidity. There's an additional question, which is a little bit orthogonal to what we've been talking about so far. Zoltan Pulsar has written on this several times, and that relates to the impact of the Fed's foreign repo pool in taking up balance sheet space. This is a longstanding facility, but in the last 5 years since the Fed lifted the caps on its use, it's at least tripled in size. To the degree that foreign official institutions were or are selling treasuries to invest in the pool, the already growing market supply of treasuries will be further increased. And in any case, the pool is going to create another non-reserve liability. All right, now to regulation. So let me begin with two introductory points before I get to the questions. First, as I alluded to a minute ago, the various regulations that various people have blamed for the price spike were in place for at least several years before September. Yet until a few months ago, while there were a few hints of possible problems as the Fed began to reduce its balance sheet, there hadn't been any repo disruptions. So to the degree that one feels the need to rethink the regulatory framework, it must be because of the interaction of that framework with some of the developments that people have already chronicled. My second introductory point is that for both heuristic and policy purposes, it may be useful to distinguish between regulatory requirements directed at the size of banks' balance sheets, read capital there, and those directed at the composition of assets on those balance sheets, broadly speaking, read liquidity there. Beginning with balance sheet size, notwithstanding some of the instant commentary that suggested that the enhanced supplemental leverage ratio and or the G-SIB surcharge bore responsibility for the September price spike, the evidence that I at least have seen to date seems fairly thin. The largest banks all had room within their leverage ratio requirements to increase lending, although this might not always be the case. And in any case, for purposes of the quarterly reporting of leverage ratios, the asset component of the denominator is based on the median size of the balance sheet over each day of the quarter. So a truly temporary increase to take advantage of the price spike could have been smoothed out in the remainder of the quarter. Now, with respect to the G-SIB surcharge, it is indeed the case that the formula for determining the surcharge bucket into which a bank falls, it does take into account the amount of repo financing undertaken by the bank. And it is true that the repo amount is measured at the end of each quarter, not just at the end of the year. So you can see that there might have been the motivation to take the repo component of the G-SIB surcharge formula into account even in Q3. But the impact of that is fairly attenuated. A pretty big decrease in repo financing will not shave that many points off the surcharge score. And as various market analysts have noted in the intervening few months, in past years, banks have made more adjustments in other balance sheet items where the bang for the adjustment, as it were, is greater. But if a bank is close to the cutoff between brackets, every little bit of regulatory arbitrage may help, and thus there may well be some incentive there. I think the G-SIB surcharge issue raises several questions. First, would it really make sense to reduce capital requirements for the very largest, most systemically important banks just so that they can ramp up their repo activity? The musing by some observers that the September price spike was significantly accounted for by J.P. Morgan staying on the sidelines arguably reinforces rather than undermines the case for a higher capital surcharge. A key motivation for the post-crisis reforms was to take account of the systemic importance of institutions whose weakness or failure could disrupt the whole financial system. This is especially important in the case of runnable short-term funding. Reducing capital requirements to facilitate a private bank becoming a quasi-lender of last resort would seem to pervert the very aim of requiring extra resiliency as the systemic footprint of the bank grows. Second, might it not be better regulatory policy to calculate most metrics for the surcharge formula, including repo activity, based on averages over the course of the preceding year, rather than on a point in time or a 4 points in time basis? This would both accommodate temporary increases in some bank activity, even at the end of the year, because you'd be working with an average from the preceding 360 days, while precluding the window dressing exercise by which a bank that is engaged in higher levels of that activity over the course of the year artificially slims down for a quarterly or annual snapshot of its balance sheet. Third, the window dressing exercise that can involve year-end reductions in repo activity does reflect the cliff effect disadvantage of the bucket approach to surcharges as adopted by the Financial Stability Board following the financial crisis. That is, for those of you unfamiliar with this, the formula produces a score for the bank, for the systemically important bank, but those scores are then put into several distinct buckets. So banks with somewhat different scores can be in the same bucket, and a small difference in score can mean a 50 basis point increase in your surcharge. Within the Fed, at least, this is back when we were thinking of the post-crisis regulatory regime. Within the Fed, we were thinking tentatively about more of a continuous function approach by which a bank's systemic score would correlate directly with the resulting surcharge rather than be in one of these cliff effect bucket circumstances. A change of this sort, like the previously mentioned idea of using averages rather than point-in-time measures, could be effected in a way that would be relatively capital neutral, though it would probably take more technical work than the data issue. Now, the issues raised by the repo disruption with respect to regulations affecting the composition of bank balance sheets are, for me at least, more difficult. As nearly everyone immediately recognized, the liquidity coverage ratio was essentially irrelevant in September, since treasuries and central bank reserves are treated identically. But they're not treated as fungible in resolution planning, and what I'm about to say is a contested point as to... it's contested within my own mind. I don't know what the answer is here, because both some bank executives and yesterday Vice Chair Quarles seemed to indicate that they were not treated as fungible in meeting the CLAR liquidity stress tests. That was not my recollection of the way liquidity stress testing was done, but I just don't know enough about how it's being done now, so maybe there is some such effect. I know there is, though, in the resolution planning context. Now, the specific requirements under both these frameworks are not published, so it's hard to draw any conclusions as to how binding these requirements may be. But during J.P. Morgan's Q3 earnings call in October, Jamie Dimon identified these requirements as the constraint that prevented J.P. Morgan from doing more repo, and said his bank is required to maintain at least $60 billion in intraday reserves at the Fed. Although one would expect that J.P. Morgan's size and complexity would mean that its requirement is considerably higher than that of other banks, even some rough back-of-the-envelope calculations would suggest that the aggregate requirement for all banks could be quite significant. Now, why would supervisors discriminate between treasuries and reserves? As a creditworthiness matter, there's not much difference between reserves and treasuries. But treasuries do need to be monetized. And in stress circumstances, when liquidity providers generally become more cautious, even as borrowers need more funding, monetization through other market actors may not be immediately possible. So if the aim of resolution planning and liquidity requirements more generally is to assure funding self-sufficiency by banks under all circumstances, there will be a preference for reserves. So long as reserves have been plentiful, this preference was a feasible regulatory choice. If they prove not to be, though, the requirements might contribute to the kind of episode that has motivated this conference. Given the pace of increase in the supply of treasuries created by the post-2017 budget deficits, the importance of the asymmetric treatment of treasuries and reserves may become more significant. And I do think that's a regulatory issue that's worth revisiting, again, with the problem that for those of us outside the Fed, we don't have the numbers. We just have a kind of conceptual framework. Now, as always, one must caution that the mere fact that a regulatory requirement contributes to reduced lending or some other financial outcome does not clinch the argument for changing the regulation. That depends on the seriousness of the effect, as well as the relative availability of alternative means both to address the effect and to achieve the financial stability aims that motivated the regulation in the first place. But as I say, that one, it seemed to me that Jamie had a very plausible account of what part of regulation might actually be playing a role. And that one, I think, at least, is worth talking about, in part because of my closing remark here, which is to suggest an even broader regulatory issue that I think was implicated by the repo episode, although you wouldn't need to tackle this big issue in order to deal with the repo episode. The post-crisis approach to liquidity regulation, and here the liquidity coverage ratio is relevant, requires banks to amass large quantities of liquid assets to ensure their self-sufficiency during periods of stress. I have for some time been concerned that while this approach does a reasonable job of countering what Jean Tirole called the underhoarding of liquidity by banks during normal times, it may exacerbate the problem of banks overhoarding liquidity during stress periods, and it does little, if anything, to address the use of runnable funding by shadow banks. Having every regulated bank completely self-insure its liquidity needs, even under severe stress or failure, may make sense as a microprudential matter. You can see the logic of it. But if every bank must sit on its pool of readily usable liquidity in anticipation of possible failure, the result could, in periods of stress, be a decidedly suboptimal macroprudential policy that starves an already strained financial system of needed liquidity. Questions about the theoretical foundations for the current approach to liquidity regulation have been further complicated by the torrent of new Treasury issuance and the reduction in the size of the Fed's balance sheet. Now, it's neither realistic nor, I think, desirable to delay decisions on the more immediate issues surrounding Fed balance sheet policies. Devising a different approach to liquidity regulation, maybe one that centers more on sustainable funding practices rather than pools of liquidity, would take time, especially since any significant change would need to be internationally coordinated. And if an element of a different approach were to include more or less assured liquidity assistance, such as a Fed facility that would stand ready to monetize treasuries or other assets, the possible resulting increase in moral hazard would need to be addressed. But the disruption in repo markets, along with the recent reports of serious potential funding vulnerabilities among non-banks involved in mortgage lending, together remind us from two very different points that liquidity regulation remains an important, unfinished piece of post-crisis regulatory reform. Thank you. And we'll stand up here, right?
Thank you all for that. I have a few simple-minded questions, and then I'm going to turn it over to the audience for people who have much more sophisticated questions than I have. So my first question is, I draw from what the three of you said that this is a little bit of a lot of attention to something that you don't think is a very big problem. It's a symptom of the Fed learning what ample reserves means. It's maybe a symptom of some unintended consequences of liquidity regulation that we could tweak a little bit. It's a symptom of changes in the way the market works. But bottom line, we shouldn't make radical changes because even though this looks very dramatic and makes a lot of us think, oh, my God, this is 2007, 2008 all over again, it's not. Have I completely turned everything you said upside down, or do I have it right?
I'm okay. I'm so lucky I get to go first. Not quite. I do not disagree that if some of the things that both Dan and Jerome pointed out, and certainly stories that one hears, happen in a period of true financial stress, liquidity hoarding, and I'll use that word, by the very largest financial institutions when they themselves have ample liquidity would be a mess and a complete disaster. My argument about allowing for a certain amount of volatility is partly to learn exactly amongst the regulations, not just of banks, but I would say also some of the other regulatory changes, about what is it that is creating the binding constraint and could particularly, to our best estimate, cause a problem in a period of true financial stress. And so that's part of the reason I think this is worth looking at carefully and taking some time to learn a little mm-hmm. from at least a moderate amount of volatility, if that's possible. Also, the regulations are not going to change fast. And so better that you start now. If you think you might, you think there are pieces that you want to tinker with. That is a slow boat, as we all know.
I'll just add to that. You know, the focus ultimately is the concern, not necessarily with primary liquidity within the market, but thinking about those second-order impacts to the market, meaning those that are impacted by the higher rates that we saw back in September, and more importantly, how the regulations by those primarily non-primary dealer participants could be impacted and how it's perceived. And that's the market risk that we have currently. Maybe some regulatory changes can alter that in the future. But the systemic, if that's viewed as a systemic impact, and how to what degree, that's something that as practitioners we have to gauge and manage against and think about how it could impact the broader capital markets.
And so the point is that if this is a symptom of something much bigger and people perceive that it's a symptom of something much bigger, it could have the ripple effects could be big. Is that your point?
Well, it may not be. I mean, quite honestly, it might be decided that you know the ripple effect might be somewhat subdued. Let's mm-hmm. put this in context. Context is important. The markets that were impacted, while severe on the overnight repo basis, was the repo market.
Right.
It wasn't the FX markets. It wasn't the basis markets. There's a lot of other markets that remain relatively inoculated from any type of further volatility, if you want to call it that. So it might be decided that whoever needs that marginal liquidity, it's just a function of that they were on the wrong side of managing the liquidity during those points of stress. I think the broader point is the fact that, keeping again in context that the G-SIBs were basically not short of liquidity back in September. That clearly was not the case. Regulations did exactly what they intended to do, and that's fine. It's the consequence of thinking about how they manage that liquidity against their own internal liquidity buffers,
right.
and ultimately how that comes into play with the CELA requirements, et cetera. And
that's we're going to keep this an acronym free zone. You're violating the rules.
One, so there's no more.
You've
no
used
more
up your quota.
Yep, that's it.
So, basically, what you're saying is the big banks had lots of cash, and the big conundrum is given that they could have lent this cash for very high interest rates, they didn't.
Well, cash is not liquidity always to everybody.
Right.
And I think that's what when thinking about it as a practitioner, you have to realize that
right.
that's the friction within the market that exists today.
Dan, you can answer that question. Did you want to add something?
Yeah. Sorry, just one small thing. This the second order effects that Jerome talks about really matter. Most of the U.S. financial system is not banks. Most of it is non-banks. And if the dependency, at least at the moment, is on that group and the liquidity stays there, that's not going to necessarily be helpful from a credit formation.
So Jay Powell and John Williams noted this in their letter to Congressman McHenry, firms not subject to bank regulation, such as money market funds, GSEs, pension funds, also seem reluctant to step in and take advantage of very high repo rates in mid-September. Okay. So why is that?
Inexperience. Nobody had seen it in 12 years. Nobody has a limit. Nobody
yeah.
has a trader. I'm sorry. I shouldn't say that.
I think
someone who actually runs a desk.
We'll be collecting liquidity at the back of the room when this is over.
Well, I think that there were participants who stepped in, but maybe not to the degree that was satisfactory. Let's clearly, you know, if you get to a 10% repo rate when it should be, you know, sub 2, that's some supply-demand mismatch. But I do think that this all goes back to my point about thinking about the context of capital and more importantly, liquidity management and being defensive in that regard. And to those who are potentially susceptible to changes in funding costs, have to think about it as a more elaborate approach to deal with this dynamicism that now exists in the marketplace. So is it a bad thing? No, it just simply this episode highlights the awareness that the framework and paradigm simply needs to be adapted at that point in time.
So, Dan, A, should we worry? And B, I was asked the following question at Thanksgiving by my niece's fiance who works on Wall Street. He said to me, everybody I work with thinks that when the Fed increases the balance sheet by $280 billion, that's QE, and they just don't want to admit it. What would you have said to him?
There we go. On the first point, on the first question you asked, yeah, to a considerable extent, I took the episode to reinforce my concern about the liquidity regulatory system in general. The two parts of it, the one I spoke a little bit about, which is the emphasis on pools that may never get effectively drained. And the second is that we're not, as Trish just said, we haven't brought into this system most of the U.S. financial system. And so in effect, I think, I mean, nobody would say this, but in effect, we're asking JP and Citi and maybe a few others to be the liquidity insurers for the entire financial system, which strikes me as not a particularly good position to be in. So that's why it just provoked these broader thoughts on liquidity regulation. As you can tell from what I said, I was trying to be sort of neutral on this, but I do think that allowing more, anticipating more, and almost demanding more volatility is actually a good thing. On the point, you know, QE, quantitative easing is presumably designed to try to affect interest rates or the shape of the yield curve or just where you are. That's not what the purpose of the bill purchases, and they are bill purchases by the Fed. They're not 10 years that are being purchased. And so I'm sure that their aim is not to change the federal funds rate. They expect that the bills are going to roll off and they're not going to have that effect. I mean, we'll see. Sometimes people are surprised, but it certainly isn't QE in motivation, and I think the Fed has strong reason to believe it won't be QE in effect.
Right. Okay. So one final question, if I could just get a simple answer, a quick answer, and then I'm going to go to the audience. If it were up to you, would you create a standing repo facility at the Fed that would lend not only to primary dealers but a broader array of counterparties? Yes or no? All of you.
You can't say yes. You're not.
It's like the siping of the presidential debates. Raise your hand, you know?
So my answer to that is going to be after three breakfasts with my colleagues from the business school and the econ department, I still don't know what I think
about. Okay, that's a good answer.
If your concern is of the second order impact to the market, then obviously it has to be yes.
Yeah.
If not, then obviously no.
I'm going to be careful how I phrase this, since I sat on this stage and actually talked about preparedness for the next financial crisis about a year ago. Well, I'm looking at Bill English over on a chapter that we wrote, and one of our preparedness things was the Fed needs to figure out in advance, at least in extremis, how it would lend to the non-banking part of the financial institution. And one way to do that, without invoking 13.3 and a whole lot of other legal hoops, is to set up a facility that would basically take acceptable collateral with a relatively wide range of counterparties. None of those things would violate any of the new restrictions in Dodd-Frank. Whether it should be there all the time or not is the part that I'm still somewhat undecided about. But should it be there and should it be known that the Fed could do this in extremis? I think that level of moral hazard, at least I could deal with. Of course, I'm not a regulator either.
So just to... That paper and a number of others on are from a conference we did on the 10th anniversary of the crisis will be published by the Yale University Press in a book called First Responders in February of next year. And I promise you that Trish and Bill English will personally autograph your copies if you buy one. There are a lot of people here. I'm going to take two or three questions, then we'll go around. There's a woman there. Could you stand? So, favor, wait for the mic. Tell us who you are and be respectful. There are a lot of people here, so let's keep it short.
Viva Hammer, many people here have been talking about the idealness of volatility, and although raising the question, haven't addressed how you create a range for ideal volatility and what you want to accomplish from volatility. Is it just information, or is there something else that the market needs? Is it a kind of an inoculation against further volatility, or is it something more specific about the information that volatility gives to the market? So two parts. What is there a range? Should there be a range? How is it calculated? And second of all, what do you want to achieve by doing that?
Over here, there was someone. If you stand up, the mic will find an easier time finding you.
Yes, thank you. Professor Turley, you mentioned...
Can you tell us who you are?
George Selgin, Cato Institute, pardon. You mentioned Pozar's writing about the role of the foreign repo pool. You didn't mention the role of the TGA, though Patricia talked about that a little bit. That's also another liability that used to be controlled very narrowly through cooperation between the Fed and the Treasury. My question for you and all the speakers who would like to answer is, why isn't the Fed talking about trying to rein in those liabilities by having foreign central banks and the Treasury take advantage of or come up with alternative places to park their dollars?
TGA is a Treasury account.
Sorry about
that. Over here in the front, if you stand up, the mic will have an easier time finding you.
Hi, Nancy Jacklin. I was wondering, you talked about the changes in this market since before the crisis, 2005. And I was wondering, in looking at the behaviors, have you taken a look at things like the fact there's only one tri-party repo facility now? It's Bank of New York, and J.P. Morgan is out of it. And the reasons they got out of it may also be affecting the reasons they're not there to continue to provide as much liquidity. And on the demand side, is there a real difference in who in the second-order participants is really looking for all this short-term financing? In other words, is the demand in this market substantially changed, not just because of the amount of government borrowing that's out there that needs to be financed in the market, but is there a lot of longer-term demand, what should be demand for longer-term funds seeking shorter-term funds, and so distorting supply and demand dynamics in this market?
Okay, so you shouldn't all feel the need to answer every question, but we should get an answer to each question. So volatility. Why do we want volatility, and how much is too much?
I don't know how much is too much, but I think you mentioned several complementary reasons why you do want some volatility. I mean, to me, thinking of it as a policymaker, the most important thing is you don't want a situation in which markets get used to the notion that anytime there's a hiccup, somebody, usually a central bank, steps in. Because then, if somebody has a big hiccup, nobody will have developed, either prepared for or developed the capacity to respond adroitly to whatever is going on in markets. They won't have really priced risk in appropriately. And so to me, from a policy perspective, that is what's important. I think Jerome could probably speak better to the learning on the market side, but I think it's basically the flip side of what I was saying a minute ago.
Yeah, I would concur with some of that. There's from a practitioner point of view, you have to have these degrees of freedom, and not everybody has them the same as pre-crisis. And so the cost of that liquidity is inherently correlated to the volatility you see in the market. To that regard, the fact that we've had zero volatility or near zero volatility because of monetary policy and other structural changes lends itself to, when any does occur, it becomes this headline grabbing experience when, frankly, it shouldn't. And it's something that the repo markets have, as we've seen from the charts that Trish highlighted, is something that we're just reverting back to the old normal, if you will. So with that regard, we just have to adapt and think about modest volatility as being part of the day-to-day structure, especially over reporting dates like quarter ends and year ends, especially if we don't get out of this habit of discrete reporting periods.
So, Trish, do you want to take the tri-party? Should we worry that there's only one tri-party?
There are reasons to be concerned that there's only one tri-party provider, but I don't think in the context of volatility, frankly. Honestly, I'm guessing I have to go back and my rough memory is that they were the Bank of New York was probably at least 75% of the tri-party market in 2005 as well. So I don't think it's really correlated with
Just to be clear, the tri-party market is where the lender and the borrower work through an intermediary. In
Correct.
This case, the Bank of New York.
Right now,
as compared to other deals where it's just between the borrower and the lender, and there isn't.
Correct. Correct. And in 2005, there were two institutions who did that, Bank of New York Mellon and J.P. Morgan Chase. Now there's only Bank of New York Mellon. It was always a very, frankly, always having a small number of infrastructure is a risk, but it's a different kind of a risk from this. I'll also make a comment about George's question about the Treasury account and the foreign repo pool. I'm probably showing an old-fashioned central banker here, but I have no idea whether the Fed is speaking to those counterparties about those the facilities or not, but my personal opinion is that they should be. The Treasury account has always been a source of volatility, and it's one reason that it was very small historically. And in fact, the volatility was kept as low as it humanly could. Let me be clear that the foreign repo pool is not particularly a source of volatility on the Fed's liability size. It's just large. And on top of that, these are people who could be, or institutions, who very easily in private markets, if they were did not repo with the Fed, could in fact be opportunistically take advantage, not exactly arbitrage because they're not intermediaries, but literally take advantage and help to close some of the gap in when you have things like spikes in repo. And so the fact that they're on this side as opposed to that side of the ledger.
You mean the foreign central bank doesn't go into the market and help smooth this volatility because Right. they have this special deal with the bank?
Exactly. Thank you.
Sure. Here. You stand up, please. And then there's one in the back. In the back, if you stand up, the mic will. Yeah, thank you.
Sean Egan, Egan Jones Ratings Company. We are named the number one firm for warning about the credit crisis of 2008 by Fortune magazine. My question is, what if you're wrong? What if this is an early indication of bigger problems? And that is, and you don't know, by the way, ahead of time, that is that you have a structural change in the indebtedness of a lot of countries that are right now using their central banks to support the funding needs of various countries. And what if this is an early indication, not of some mismatching or anything of that, but a more structural problem? What early indications might you have, and how do you respond?
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Sebastian Infante. I have a question that regarding the drain of liquidity, the triggers were the settlement of Treasury and of tax payments, and those presumably settled on the 16th. And yet we saw the biggest increase in volatility on the 17th. So my question was that surprising to people on the panel? And may that be an important piece of evidence for us to think about how banks actually manage liquidity in terms of what they've experienced and what they think may be happening going forward? Thank you.
There's a woman here. If you stand up, please.
Thank you. My name is Una MacDonald. I have rather a different question. Does the volatility experienced in September and the Fed's, New York Fed's continuing support of the repo rate, does that not affect the usefulness of SOFRA as the replacement benchmark for LIBOR, particularly in view of the fact that SOFRA is essentially a backward-looking rate, whereas LIBOR, which I believe should be retained, is a forward-looking rate? Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Let's start with the narrow ones first. So is there something about the 16th and 17th, Jerome, that tells us something?
No. I mean, quite honestly, we started to see it very early in the morning on the 16th. And so while it wasn't headline grabbing for probably, another 36 hours, quite honestly. It was something that, that we saw starting probably about 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. Well, that's Pacific time, so sorry about that.
Jerome told me he gets up at 3 a.m. every morning. That's the advantage of living in California.
It's all dark. It doesn't matter where you are. So, but there was...
Tim Co-Trader says we're all in the dark.
Did not say that.
Sorry. Right.
My media folks are going crazy right now. Thanks. Anyway, in all sincerity is, if anything, we're not in the dark about the liquidity markets. We always continue to look at them on a real-time basis for that barometric pressure indicator. So what I would say is the transmission mechanism worked effectively. What we started to see is the second-tier demands start to come in what we call reg repo. The repo not for cash settlement, meaning same day on that Monday, but the one for T+1, meaning the Tuesday and beyond, which is why it was very useful for the market to only be placated once we had a response that was term in nature, not simply the overnight market operations that were one day overnight, but we had something going for, you know, 2 weeks at a time. So getting ahead of the curve is essential. So we did see it pretty early on. Again, we often have settlement. We often have late-day blips in terms of funding. That's something that we've always dealt with in market operations and funding operations. But it also leads to we typically will see these blips materialize now in this current paradigm, T+1, meaning trading for tomorrow's settlement, because that's a way that the banks can avoid their daylight overdraft charges.
So, Dan, what if this is an indication of something bigger and we just don't understand what it is?
Well, I mean, two things about that. One, you always have to kind of do your best, you know, make your best judgment, because at some level you can be wrong about everything. So in terms of policy response, that's the way people have to think, number one. Number two, I guess three things. Number two, when something happens that in and of itself is not hugely troubling, but you think it may reveal some problems somewhere else, you should probably spend some time. That's why it's provoked me to talk more about liquidity regulation writ large in the system. And three, and this is really quite important. So when the Fed created the office, now Division of Financial Stability, part of the idea was what Nellie and the people who started that office did was to basically take everything that was happening that the mainstream Fed staff said, oh, yeah, it's okay. Don't worry about that. This is okay. And ask the question, well, what if it's not okay? You know, what else might be going on to have produced this? And it wasn't that they believed it all the time, but they were an institutionalized intellectual devil's advocate that we thought of, and I know the guys at the Bank of England think the same way, as an important institutional component of any financial regulatory system. But you've got to invite it, you have to actually foster it, and you can't get angry with people when they tell you there may be a bigger problem here than you think. And I hope that's still going on at the Treasury, at the FSOC and the Fed.
I actually interpreted your question slightly differently as much more of a fiscal risk. Maybe that's because I just misheard you. So correct me, a combination. And there's absolutely no question that the degree of fiscal risk in the United States is higher. It's very high in Japan. Of course, it's been very high in Japan for a long time. Not as high in Europe, although in certain countries it is, obviously. The U.S., of course, has unbelievably exorbitant privilege of being the benchmark currency for the rest of the world, and so it's incredibly difficult to judge. It has happened historically that demand for U.S. treasuries has gone up. But it's very difficult to know exactly when that point is because it happens very rarely. So is that a risk? I think it is. It's a financial stability risk. It gets highlighted. I don't know that there are many signals other than the repo market having a little trouble swallowing things, but that's happened a lot without there being an actual fiscal crisis. So I don't know, but it's certainly worth keeping an eye on, particularly given that the size of the deficits are not going to be going down anytime soon, as far as I can tell.
Trish, we're switching from the London interbank offered rate to the secured overnight financing rate, which I will not define. Is that, does this anything tell us anything about that?
I'm actually less concerned about that. The part of the LIBOR transition that I'm more concerned about is the fact it was the last thing you said, which is that this is not a forward rate. There's not a forward market yet. It's just an overnight rate. There will be, or there needs to be, for it to be viable. Yes, exactly. No, and I know the deadlines, which is interesting. I'm not close enough to the debate to know, or to the inner workings of what's going on to know. Maybe other people know more about this. But my much bigger concern is, when is that forward market going to get going and be big enough that we can actually use that? It's actually usable.
So.
Do you have a final word on that?
Okay. I wanted to address a question that was posed that wasn't addressed.
Okay. Yes.
So
right.
I'm going to not get this 100% correct, but the question basically was: is there something in the market structure today that lends for potential disruption between the demand for term funding, term liabilities, and asset mix? And I think it's important to say that this has always been a function of the market. And typically, back in the day, you had commercial banks who had a much more fungible balance sheet and appetite that provided that term funding at a cost, because that's what they do. But now in this environment, there's been things to supplant that and to obviously change that risk tolerance. One of those things, quite honestly, is the evolution of the structured, is the evolution of the sponsored repo market. And what sponsored repo basically is effectively taking collateralized lending and moving it to centrally cleared domains. The point I would make there is that a lot of that is done via overnight demands, overnight repos. And so while there is incremental supply of balance sheet, it's coming in the form of very short-dated appetite. And I would just say that one of the things as a risk manager we always think about is that cost of liquidity, and more importantly, how to more appropriately structure that. But just because you have ample liquidity to meet on a daily basis supply and demand doesn't necessarily mean that the term horizon for funding has actually been met. So it's a great evolutionary development in the funding in the repo markets. But at the same time, we should also be cognizant that there's the potential for that mismatch to open up one day, and we need to be prudent about how we approach that as we are.
Okay, I want to thank the panel. We're only just beginning. We're going to take a 10-minute break, so we'll resume. There's coffee outside, but we're going to try and get going shortly after 3 o'clock, so drink quickly or whatever else you have to do.